Go. We're all present, all members of the authority. I would like to start with a moment of silence to think about, reflect on the greatness of Nelson Mandela. So if we could take a moment of silence, that would be good. Got a lot of paper flying around. This, by the way, is the Gaming Regulatory Oversight Authority meeting again. Next to last meeting, perhaps the last meeting, I doubt that. We've got a lot of work to do today. There's a lot of paper flying around. We have an agenda, very short. Self-explanatory. We have a redraft of the expanded gaming bill. For most of you, it's double-sided. Mine happens to be single-sided. Related to that, there's an addendum of additional proposed changes. It's two-sided. Sent that out last night. Related to that, there's a one-page, three-item list, believe it or not, reflecting additional changes from this morning. That's all having to do with the expanded gaming bill. And you should all have a draft final report. Looks like that. And you should all have a draft, I'm calling it in the text elsewhere, existing gaming bill relative to charity games of chance, just double space. And you may have other paper too, but that's all I can find. They're now posted on the website, the report of White Sand Gaming consolidated. It had been in three parts, and it is now integrated into a single report as their final report, all 145 pages of it, and that is available on the website. Also on the website, I believe now, are all of the main documents, the expanded gaming bill, the existing gaming bill, and the draft report of the authority. So that's what we have. Many have contributed to this redraft, and I think you know who you are. So I thought, unless somebody has a better way of doing this, that what we will undertake to do is to go through this page by page. And I say this, I mean the expanded gaming bill, picking up random items as we go. It's a lot. And I hope we can all discipline ourselves and speak to what needs to be spoken to and move on. Hopefully we will have easy consensus or silent consensus as we move on from page to page. And there will be, I'm sure, some substantive conversation on some of the issues. So we'll just work through it. Some of the issues repeat themselves, so when we're taking care of one in one place, we'll find that we'll move right by it later on. If I can get myself organized, we'll start down that pathway, unless somebody has a better way to do it, or somebody, any member here wants to open with a statement or comments. Ready to go? All right. Start with the first page, statement of purpose. There's one change on there. Actually, two. The second paragraph changed problem gambling to problem gambling, which seems is the term that we're using throughout this document. It's more appropriate for the problem part of gaming, problem gambling. And then there's a slight rewording of subsection of paragraph four. That's just to try to say it better, I think. I had nothing until I get to page four. Please speak up if you see something or you mark something that you want to talk about. On page four, there is an addendum item, a new definition of game. It's a simpler definition. Maureen Williamson developed this, and it simply leaves out some extraneous material, I believe.
Is that correct? It's really designed to fit a little better with the criminal statutes and the changes in RSA 647.
Okay. Basically technical. I go on to page five, and that too is a addendum item. Attorney Williamson, perhaps you could explain that too.
Really, that was just amplifying merchandise or other non-cash prize, just a more general statement because we had to define merchandise. Executive Director McIntyre suggested that. I think that was a good inclusion.
All right.
Just a clarification of the existing.
Clarification. All right. And that's the same on the next page, I believe. Yeah. And the next change I come to is on page eight. I think this was just correcting an inaccurate description of what we had. Maybe it had been written before we specifically defined the gaming control division.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this simply reflects that reality. And on page 10, there's new language, a table game in which a player competes against another player. I believe the previous language was a non-banked game or something like that,
exactly.
And which was a phrase that at least one member didn't understand, understandably. And so this simply says what's happening. It's just making it clearer. And then we come to page 11, and before we get to the highlighted thing there, there is an important item in the addendum. It's page 11, line 33. And the new language reads, there shall be, and hereby is created, a New Hampshire Gaming Commission. The Gaming Commission shall be an executive branch agency entitled to defense and indemnity under RSA 99D. It shall consist of five members. And I believe that's the product of conversations with the Attorney General's office.
Correct. And that was an important clarification for the agency going forward.
All right. Down below that, on the same page, is language that we put in reflects Attorney Sullivan's suggestion that we have some level of specialty within the commission, and that's what that is. All right, page 12. Oh, well, except as the context may otherwise require, we're still keeping a state lottery commission and still keeping a racing and charitable gaming commission. In some places in this statute, we have to refer to those entities, and so we don't want them always to be read as the gaming commission, and that's all that does. So I'm up to page 13. And this is new language. And it's also discussed in a, there's an alternative to the language you see here in the addendum. Essentially, this language deals with the startup of the Gaming Commission and enables it to draw on funds coming in from existing gaming, essentially as an advance to be paid back, which is essentially how this authority is functioning with the small amount of money we have. And so it would make that explicit and would have the payback under the language that's in the text of the draft bill occur upon the issuance of the gaming license, when, at least under this version, a large amount of money would come in. The alternative that Maureen Williamson put out was changing the authorization to spend, which that's all this is, to continue until an operations certificate is issued, which is a later date. There's elsewhere, further back in here, there's the payback language. So the payback's going to occur either way. And I actually thought, as I reflected on it, that maybe Maureen Williamson's language was the better way to go, since after you get the licensing fee and payback, which I think would be in the language, there will still be a gap in time as you go forward until you get to receipt of operating revenues. So the idea here is to provide for a smooth, functioning startup of the commission. That's all it is.
So these are education trust fund dollars? Is that what they otherwise would be?
No, they wouldn't have gone into the education trust fund.
They're being trapped outside of.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly, I could, Mr. Chair, that's not uncommon. It's happened a number of times previously, funding for this. The funding for the Gaming Commission you sat on, the assistance was paid for by our revenues. The 2010 Study Commission, that was paid for by our revenues as well.
All right. Do we have a better way to go here, operation certificate or gaming license? Want to say anything about that?
I just think that the way the funding is, depending on how the general court were to allow a distribution and what they would allocate from funds that were received in a licensing fee, this gives you a little more dexterity to say the end point for the commission would be once you have a licensee that's paying tax. And you have a mechanism for addressing anything else before that. So it just seems that this is a little bit cleaner, and there certainly will be tracking and there certainly will be repayment. So it just makes it, I think, a little less dramatic for the agency. I think there is, as the executive director is saying, it's a fairly typical precedent in emerging jurisdictions to have basically a borrowing and a repayment mechanism in place.
You need a vote to recommend the addendum language versus what the draft language is?
That may be an appropriate way to proceed as we go through this. A preliminary vote that would indicate the preference on this one.
Well, pertinent to this discussion, then I would support using the addendum language to replace what was in the draft, but that section A.
I would second that.
All right. Discussion? Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. So go to the addendum. All right. There is an addition right below that. This has to do with the code of ethics of the commissioners, and there's a prohibition on the receipt by a commissioner or employee of any commission, bonus, and so forth, with the exception of items valued at $25 or less. And we've extended the exception to his or her immediate family. The immediate family, by the way, is defined at the front end of this document to include those that live in the household and otherwise meet what everybody might assume are members of an immediate family. But they have to live in the household. And this excludes the de minimis gifts. It parallels exactly the exclusion that applies to state employees. Okay, what's this? Well, this is just a technical one, I think, down below that, extending the terminology. Okay, on line 45 of 14, page 14, I've got an addendum item. Do you want to speak to that, Marie?
This is subsection 15.
Yes.
This is really just a modification that basically provides that it will be the commission that will determine who's considered a major policy holding position within the agency. We've already spelled out, obviously, that the executive director would be. It's likely that the top directors in each department, maybe the chief financial officer, general counsel, others would fall into that category. So that really just gives that authority to designate those positions.
All right. Well, I'm on to the next page. This is the organization of the commission into divisions, and we discussed last time the lack of clarity in reporting relationships. I believe Director McIntyre made that observation. When I looked closely at what we'd done, I saw that we'd really failed to flesh that out, and that it was fleshed out for the new gaming control division, but it was not for the lottery and racing and charitable gaming divisions. So all of this highlighted language is really the same as, but with differences, the language that was in, that it continues, that's in now in paragraph 6 and 7 on the next page. The language for the lottery commission, the lottery and the racing and charitable gaming divisions includes the obligation of each of these divisions to provide support to the work of their respective remaining continuing commissions in the work that those commissions do by delegation from the Gaming Commission. Now that's a clarification. I sense as it works. I've had some feedback. If there are any comments on it, this is the time. All right. There's new language here. Maybe you could speak to this, Maureen, on the next page, page 16.
What we're doing in the context of this particular provision is providing for the scenario that the gaming control division within the commission, which is the regulatory piece with primary responsibility for expanded gaming, may need to reach out to obtain a number of professionals with specific expertise in gaming. And these individuals are not readily available within the state system, and this is a provision to say the commission may, should it determine it necessary to do so, designate certain professional employees as serving at the pleasure of the commission outside the general classification system. This is something that if you look at precedents in other states, in Pennsylvania, in Massachusetts, in Ohio, in many states, because of a very limited pool of people available with the expertise to serve, say, as an executive director of an agency like this, to effectively serve and get you on the ground running, you may need to go outside the salary constraints of the normal classified service. But, you know, I'm certainly not an expert in New Hampshire classification systems, but I assume there's always an executive level service at the pleasure of the agency type position. And really, this is just, I'm hopeful that this language works, but that's certainly the concept that's developed.
Okay, just to be clear, the language we're talking about is the language that's in the addendum 16/41. And so that's the genesis of it. Yes?
My only question to that is that almost sounds like this would be a consultant versus an employee, but...
No, it's simply that a lot of times the salary constraints do not allow you to get the expertise that you need to fulfill these positions. And so, you know, for example, you know, in Pennsylvania, in order to lure executive-level regulators from one state to the next, generally speaking, the salaries that are offered are very often higher than the norm in state government, and they're more as if you were bringing in, and again, I'm speaking generally because obviously I have no expertise in New Hampshire per se, but the relaxation of the classification standards is not uncommon in jurisdictions. And again, this is designed by saying certain to designate certain professional employees. It's designed to be very narrow and on an as-needed basis and completely discretionary. It may be that the commission, because you have expertise here in a well-developed lottery and in well-developed charitable gaming and racing, that you might not even feel that the commission might not feel that you even needed to go outside for expertise.
It sounds good. I'm not sure whether, again, I think we need to do a little bit more checking and see whether New Hampshire were allowed to do that. I think it falls, as you said, within a consultant or contractor position. Any position, whether it's within the classification system or outside the classification system in New Hampshire, it has to go through the legislative process. And if it's a new category, then it has to go through the Hays study to create a salary. So I don't know whether our system allows it, and I think it needs general. I don't know whether you...
I see Mike Brown's there, who probably would be able to address it if somebody wanted to mm-hmm. hear it. But I think the commissioner's right. I don't know whether Mike wants to comment or not, if the commissioner...
We'd welcome that.
Wants to
sure.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Michael Brown. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General. If I understand the question correctly, and I may not, so as I review the language of the draft, one of the things that jumped out at me was a problem with regard to existing employees, both in the classified service and the unclassified service. We already have a structure. This doesn't contemplate that structure at all. And so that, in and of itself, presents issues and problems.
I'm not certain I understand that it doesn't contemplate. I mean, this was designed, and again, it's simply a recommendation. When I had spoken to Deputy Attorney General Rice, I had changed the language and tried to make it very explicit that this was really on a very ad hoc, limited basis. But certainly there's nothing else about the draft statute that would suggest any deviation from unclassified or senior-level classified employees.
Well, if I understand kind of the overall structure, you are incorporating, in essence, the Lottery Commission and the Charitable Gaming Commission into this overall structure. And if you are doing that, there are existing classified and unclassified positions.
But this is explicit to the Division of Gaming Control, that is the arm of the New Hampshire Gaming Commission that would be related directly to an expanded commercial gaming component. There's no intent to disturb in any way charitable or lottery operationally.
So it's no doubt my misunderstanding. So in essence, what you're doing is you are incorporating the two existing state agencies, and in addition to that, creating a third
yes.
entity, basically.
Yes.
And that third entity you are treating completely differently than the other.
I think the implicitly it's that it would be treated the same with a limited exception that's discretionary for designated certain professional
members. Yeah, I want to interrupt just for a sec. And try to narrow this discussion, because there is, as Attorney Williamson said, nothing that I know of. Maybe you can single it out, or maybe we need to discuss having something else, but nothing that I know of in this statute that creates an exception for this commission with respect to the old or the new on the question of classified or unclassified positions. What we're talking about here is this one provision that would allow the commission to designate certain professional employees with specialized gaming expertise as serving at its pleasure. And maybe that's a bad idea, maybe it's a good idea, but that's all we're talking about right here.
At a salary structure not contemplated by the existing system.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the question. Can this commission hire a $250,000 employee?
And I don't know that it's something it's not a core piece here. This was just something that having been involved in many jurisdictions.
Okay, Director McIntyre.
I mean, certainly that's precedent. My position that was created was outside the salary structure in the 60s. And in order to lure then head of the FBI from Boston up to New Hampshire, he was far and away the highest paid state employee outside the classification system without term. And that thereafter, a period of years, sort of was absorbed in the state system, but certainly that process has precedent for my title.
If the question is literally that narrow, and the answer is, of course you can do that, and there is precedent, I think about the physicians, for example, who are hired by the state of New Hampshire, fall way outside of the framework that we usually have, and so this would be kind of different than that.
Yeah, I mean, I would think in the exercise, this would be maybe three people, not even.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In the interest of moving along, I would suggest that because we have an opinion that it's not actually illegal under our current system, and knowing that it is going to be very controversial when it comes up for debate in all kinds of different directions. My suggestion is that because it's not illegal, we say that this is good policy in terms of attracting the kind of employee we might want to attract, approve it, and move along to the next question.
Is that a motion?
That is a motion.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the motion, raise your hands. Yes? Okay. All right, thank you. There's another addendum item that comes in right at the top of page 17. Line 2, oh, this must be, why do I have that? 17.
Oh, it's out of order on the addendum sheet. It's on the next page of the
thank
addendum
you.
Sheet after the page 18.
Blurred eyes, it's late at night.
Keep
it's
going, turn the
second page.
After the page 18 one on the first page.
It's just out of order.
Wow.
Okay. oh, yes.
Okay.
Well, these were tweaks. I think they came out of your discussions with the Attorney General's office. Am I right about that?
Yes, and with Executive Director McIntyre, just on the proper way to frame the language on operational audits.
Okay.
And the section Roman numeral 23, definitely based on the conversation with you.
23, where are you getting 23?
I'm sorry, I may be off your document.
She's 18.
Oh, yeah, anyway. Yeah, those were basically, you know, housekeeping clarifications.
Okay.
I had in the exercise of discretion,
yeah,
after speaking with Deputy Attorney Rice, we elected to take that out.
Okay.
The main thing was that there was a deletion of any ability to change insurance.
Well, that's coming up. Yeah, that's coming up.
Okay.
All right, so let's just keep plodding along here. I'm up to page 18, and that's just some slightly different wording, financial and operational views and compliance audits, instead of just saying audits.
Right, exactly.
Being a little more explicit.
Right.
All right. And then we come down to, on page 18, to paragraph 23, which starts at line 33, and we have a change at line 38 from the addendum, as it changes the phrase to sue or be sued to just to sue. And there's some reason for that.
Thank you. Sure. Good morning. I'm Ann Rice, Deputy Attorney General.
Thank you for being here.
Sure. The reason for crossing out and deleting the or be sued was a concern for waiving sovereign immunity. We just didn't want to have that in there because that's an issue.
Sounds good.
And the same with the deletion of the insurance, it might be helpful.
That's correct. The suggestion to delete line 54, I believe, insurance, because the state's self-insured, and we didn't see that there was any need for difference with this commission.
All right. I should say, backing up at the top of this page, paragraph 23, line 33, the commission shall also have the power and duty, and new language was added, subject to all applicable provisions of state law. And this was sort of a general effort to make clear that this commission is not, you know, free of state law. It's subject to all of this. And now, as we go through the detail here, we're trying to make that even more clear. So thank you for that. I'm on to page 19. Oh, there's an error there. There's a repetition. The first K that's highlighted should just be deleted. It repeats what's in the second, except the second has been fleshed out.
One is for purposes of licensing and enforcement, including but not limited to background information to receive information. The second is receive and share information with other gaming regulating entities pursuant to an information.
Do you think they're two different things?
Yeah, I have been asked for that clarification.
Okay.
So
keep it. So that just clarifies that there's the sharing.
Exactly. That there's an authority to enter into an information sharing agreement with a gaming regulating entity.
All right. Then there's an addendum item at line 23 of this page.
Can I just go back 1 minute just to make sure we didn't really discuss it, but on page 18, 54, we deleted the insurance component,
yes,
but then we substitute, unless I'm missing it, we're substituting G with a new G, to retain attorneys with the approval of the...
No, that's just renumbering. the next paragraph on the next page of the statute.
Oh, I got it.
Got it?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I didn't do the renumbering here for the addendum changes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Got to go back around on that. Okay. Line 23 on the next page is a substantial change that's in the addendum. The new language will read, the commission, by and through its division of gaming control, shall possess, pursuant to a delegation of authority by the Attorney General, such law enforcement powers as are required to effectuate the purposes of this chapter, and so forth. And that's better language. It makes clear how things work here in New Hampshire.
Exactly. It's a very limited delegation, just to the extent that it's necessary for the good order and function of the commission.
All right. Where are we? There's some highlighted things I'm just going to flip by without talking about them because they're not worth talking about in my judgment. The next is an addendum item on page 20. It's 20, line 13. The commission, in consultation with the Attorney General, shall adopt regulations. All of which are designed to prevent commingling of legal advisory, investigatory, prosecutorial, and adjudicatory functions. So that's clearly a realm that the Attorney General has jurisdiction over, and it's important that the office be involved in the adoption of those regulations. That's the idea behind that. And the next is at line 52, page 20. Again, a insert, addendum item. A number of these, by the way, do reflect intense discussions, good discussions, productive discussions with the Office of the Attorney General in the past 48 hours. And so that's what this line two is. It reflects, I think, those discussions. Is that right?
That's right.
Yes. And the next is maybe you'd like to talk about this. Page 21, it's paragraph 4. The expense of investigation in any proceeding under this section before the commission, including but not limited to that related to an employee, shall be fully recoverable from the gaming licensee unless the commission determines otherwise. We did have a comment from Jim Demers about that. I don't recall exactly, but it set some limits on recovery, the idea.
Yes. Basically what's happening here is the intent of all of this is that the cost of regulation will be recaptured. And so in the context of a regulatory investigation and a prosecution through to a notice of violation, obviously the licensee is picking up the cost of that prosecution and is responsible for it through their assessments. What I did here was do a clarification that for a gaming licensee, they're responsible for their employees, so that we do not have a scenario where you could have an accounting violation where there are any number of people involved in it, right down to a cashier's cage cashier. And obviously, you know, the licensee is responsible for the supervision of their operation, and you do not want there to be any suggestion that you're going to try to recover from a cashier any costs related to that prosecution. So it's designed for that clarification, and it's also designed, the comment had been more in terms of if the licensee prevailed, that they would not bear the cost of prosecution. I didn't want to go that far, because just because the licensee prevails does not mean it was a malicious or incompetent prosecution. And so the language that provides, unless the commission determines otherwise, would give the commission the discretion in the event that there was a prosecution that for some reason was defective on its face, that there would be an opportunity not to, you know, have the licensee responsible, that there would be just a fairness and an equitable apportionment of those costs. So that's the sort of the nature and intent of that provision.
Okay. See, I have another addendum item. Oh, it's more of the administrative sanction, the language that was worked out in the last couple of days. So I don't think we need to discuss that. Oh, and then we come in paragraph 8 to a whole set of provisions that had not been in the previous draft that were being developed. or had they been partially in the last draft? I can't remember.
I believe the administrative, the criminal sanctions,
yes.
They had been somewhat, but this is a definitely a more amplified version.
Yeah, so these are teasing out the different criminal criminal rules that will apply in this specialized context. And they are lengthy. I don't think we need to go through them all or any in particular, unless somebody wants to highlight one. You want to say anything in general about them?
Yes. What I wanted to just emphasize is that what we did here was to take the generic cheating and swindling, the typical gambling-related offenses, and at the back of the document, you'll see an amendment to RSA 647 that includes those. And what we kept in the gaming chapter itself are criminal violations that are directly related to the regulation of gaming itself. So, for example, if a slot machine is not properly certified, tested, and approved by the commission, and it's on the floor, that's a criminal violation, and that's in the body of this, of 284B. But if it's cheating, swindling, fraud, deception, that's in the normal gambling statutes. So I think it's criminal, workable from a user perspective.
Criminal
statute. Criminal statute.
Yeah.
And I'm still assuming somewhere here that we're checking numbering because the addendum has 7, the draft has 8, so I don't know who does that minutia, but somebody will be verifying. Thank you.
All right. Page 24.
Hope you have a lot of asking.
Voluntary assistance.
All right, thank you for that. Carrying on, we're into page 24. There's, again, an addendum here. It's just making clear that the Attorney General does have this authority, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the Attorney General shall have independent authority and so forth. That's all that does. And then there is a new insert, the Attorney General shall act as legal counsel to the Commission. And I think that's the product of discussion as well. There's an important new provision. I think it's important. That's at the bottom of page 24. It's a highlighted provision. It's paragraph 4. Speaks to the obligation of these various entities to cooperate with respect to the regulatory and criminal implementation and enforcement of this chapter. And there's this added language, which efforts shall include cooperation with municipal and county attorney offices and with local law enforcement. So I'm on to the next page. Perhaps you could comment on these next two items.
Okay. In 284B8, we talk about the powers of the Division of State Police Gaming Enforcement Unit. And as you know, this particular enabling statute contemplates a full-scale entertainment complex, and that would could possibly or would likely include hotel, parking structures, and other entertainment structures. And so what this provision does is take the Division of State Police Gaming Enforcement Unit and give it primary law enforcement authority over the gaming floor and restricted areas. And restricted areas are a defined term in this document, and that's, you know, your count room, your cashier's cage, IT department, anything that's sensitive that goes to gaming revenue. And so the state police would have jurisdiction for all law enforcement related matters related to those areas, and the local police would be the primary enforcement responsibility for all other aspects of a gaming location.
I think you've jumped ahead to language that's later on.
I think she's addressing the addendum language from under 2451.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, that's right. Very good. You're absolutely right. So that's very significant language. I think, again, it reflects the product of discussion between the entities that are most engaged in this.
Right, and that's exactly, there's no right or wrong answer there. That's very jurisdiction specific. It's however way it works. And if that's what, if that bifurcation works for New Hampshire, that's exactly what you should do. Because the important thing is that it's defined and you know who's responsible for what. And I think that's been worked out.
Good. All right, so now we can move on beyond that. To page 25. And what do we have here?
Are you talking about the cooperation?
I'm on page 25. I know you're looking on your computer.
Yeah, I'm looking a little bit different. Those provisions. Okay. All these provisions do is, in keeping with this section is talking about the State Police Gaming Enforcement Unit, so it makes it clear that they have authority, notwithstanding the normal provisions on state police, to investigate on their own initiative criminal activity and violations. And I've limited this now to reflect the agreement of the parties that they would have that authority only as to the gaming floor restricted areas.
Okay.
And so both of them are amplifications, just going back to that bifurcation of responsibilities within the gaming location.
All right. And then there's this provision about on-site offices. I think that speaks for itself.
Yes. Yeah. That's very standard.
And then at line 38 of the same page, there's an addendum which simply reiterates the cooperation with local law enforcement language. Adds it in to this place as well.
If I could just ask for a clarification, in one place we use local police, and another place we use local law enforcement. Is there a preferred term?
I mean, unless General Foster says something specific wording, I mean, it doesn't really matter to me, I suppose. I mean, host community law enforcement agency or local police department. Because in New Hampshire, I don't think that any town services out its law enforcement.
So if we just use local law enforcement, that would be satisfied.
I think that's better.
That's probably better because some towns contract with the state police.
I'm not sure if it's a contract, but I know like some towns have only 400 or 500 people. I think the state police respond to all calls for service, I would think.
I don't know how it's done. I just know that they don't have police departments, so law enforcement is probably better.
Okay.
Local law enforcement agencies.
All right. We've got an addendum item on page 26, 12. This also was an outgrowth of discussions, and again, you could speak to that.
Yeah, this is really just, if you're talking about the rules relating to background investigations.
No.
It's 26, page 12.
It's an insert, yeah. Addendum item.
So that, yes, we're talking about the same section.
Okay.
If this is adding, just really amplifying or clarifying that these rules will reflect the efficient administration of the licensing process, but that licensing process and efficiency will always have to reflect the time it takes to adequately make the suitability determination as to, you know, good character, honesty, integrity, and financial stability. So it's really just an amplification of what was there.
There was a suggestion that speed would prioritize good and complete decision making. So that was supposed to balance.
Right. Got it. Now, I think we're coming to a whole bunch of stuff that was highlighted, but I think it's just fixing
right now,
words.
Right, exactly. That
yeah.
Right.
So I think we can just skip over that. Nothing substantive there that I know of. But that's revealing, by the way, of work that Maureen Williamson has been doing, because I didn't highlight a lot of stuff that's been fixed. If I'd highlighted all the stuff that's been fixed, we'd get bogged down. And we don't need to deal with that because it was just fixing. So I'm up to page 29. I've got an insert at, I guess it's line 10. Oh, before that.
What did you do with all the changes?
Before that, yeah.
Yeah.
Which changes are you looking at?
Well, 28, you changed, you added a...
We got to get that.
Review and distribution.
From the addendum, you're absolutely right. So these items... could be treated together. Marianne, could you speak to those?
Yeah, what I did here was initially I had a reference to testing protocols, and when I was looking at that in the last few days, I felt that it wasn't adequate. What's going to be happening is that New Hampshire is not going to have its own slot lab. It's going to use independent test labs. And so the first provision really just deals with the fact that there will have to be regulations that deal with the mechanics of working with those labs and receiving their certifications, and the commissioner will then have to act on the results of the reports that they receive from the labs. And so that's just a clarification of the mechanics, but it's an important regulation that we'll have to have. Down in item 7, this section in general is talking about technical standards for slot machines. And it's talking in terms of really just in providing for rulemaking. It's touching on all of the items that are typically covered in a set of technical standards. I just brought, for display purposes, like this is a set of Maryland's technical standards just on slot machines. So obviously, you know, these are voluminous, highly technical documents, but what's happening in this section is that you're really touching on the main aspects that go to security features, comprehensibility of the player wagering options and rules of play, etc. And so then there had been a discussion, and some concerns have continued to be raised by the Attorney General's office and others regarding slot machines and addictive qualities to slot machines. And so what's happening in the addendum there is to try to give a better sense of the type of design feature that would typically and most certainly be incorporated into New Hampshire's technical standards that would prevent the use of what's referred to as reflexive software, which is software that basically is sometimes used in unregulated games that would basically select a random number result, and this is a layman's version, if you will, but then look at that result and say, no, I'm going to make a secondary decision. So there are prohibitions here on things that attributes that could potentially be fraudulent or mislead a player. And so the things that are reflected, you know, the reflexive software, a requirement that there be a random number generator, the requirement at 3, where we're saying once a random selection has occurred, that the slot machine displays an accurate representation of the randomly selected outcome, and that it be prohibited from making a secondary decision which affects the result shown to the player on the slot machine. That's actually the actual legal language for the near-miss feature that we've talked about on a number of occasions. And then we're also talking about optimal skill. So where a game would have a strategy choice, if the patron were required to place an additional wager or lose credits on that strategy choice, the game would have to be designed and configured so that the map of the game basically automatically gave the player the optimal strategy. So again, very, very technical, but these are the types of things that will be developed in technical standards, will be amplified in technical standards, but just give you a sense of really convey to the reader that New Hampshire intends to have, you know, a very robust review of slot products.
Just so I'm correct here, because I see how this plugs in, we're on page 29, we're replacing the language of 7, and with the new language, we then add small Roman numerals 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then we go to 8, 9, 10, 11 unchanged.
Correct.
Right. And again, we're trying to pick up, you know, accurate reporting of transactions, broader deception, and items that minimize any potential negative consequences associated with the play of a slot machine.
So I think this is a good addition. I've been reading a book called Addiction by Design that talks about slot machines and how they're designed to keep a player playing and so forth. So your language here, is this to reduce addictive play, or is it to just not have fraud so that a player's not being misled as to what's happening? And those strike me as somewhat linked, actually. That near misses and near wins and you know, some of the techniques are to get a player to keep on playing, because of course the irony here is you keep them playing, they gamble more, they lose more, and the stake gets more. So how do you balance those things?
Maybe this is a good opportunity to introduce Sal Sherrill. Is that right? Did I have it right?
Sal Sherry. Right.
Sherry. Who is president?
CEO.
Chief Executive Officer of Chief Operating Officer of
CEO
of White Sand, and welcome. We've appreciated the work of White Sand. I see you nodding your head or responding to General Foster's comments, so I thought you might have something to say.
Absolutely. I think Attorney General Foster definitely hit on exactly, you know, the purpose of this language here. And you're right, it is, it's both, they are linked. You know, it's important to protect the integrity of the game. You know, what is displayed to the player? The player has to have a level of trust in the game. And, you know, if you go back and look at the history of gaming in the U.S., you know, there were, the regulations were not always like this. They were very, very loose, almost non-existent, you know, back in the 60s and even into the 70s. I actually spent time, I authored a book about this. You know, it's kind of very interesting to see how it's progressed over the years, because gaming really has changed dynamically in the last, you know, 30 years. And we won't even talk about the last 3 years, but, you know, being able to game on a phone now. But it's important to do two things. It's important to that the player, you know, have, you know, trust in the game. But at the same time, an entertainment value, an experience, that is not, in a way, creating an addiction. So the near miss is something that was you know, very controversial, and that's why, you know, you've seen that, you know, a lot of jurisdictions move away from that. And that's really, you know, it's striking that balance, because the goal of you know, no casino wants a customer that has a problem with the game to be there in their facility. They don't make enough money off that person for it to be
worth it to lure that type of person in and really kind of say, wow, we're getting every penny from this person. That's not their goal. They don't benefit from that. And really, truly, you know, what the goal is to have a fun experience within your limits. And whether that limit be, or your gaming budget be just for the games, or maybe it's for some other things in the casino, like a nice meal, maybe a couple of drinks, you know, at the bar, buying something at the shops. So that's really what a lot of the casino resorts are moving to today. It's about the total experience. And without this language, we really don't have the ability to you know, protect and control that experience for the customer.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
On subsection 4, I certainly agree with this provisions, these provisions and their intent. It's just the language, the very last phrase, and cannot lose any credits earned prior to the strategy choice. Wouldn't that reflect any credits earned period prior to the strategy choice, or versus that specific wager and any additional wager made off of that one sort of engagement of the machine at that moment?
The typical robust interpretation, and this is language that actually is used in New Jersey and in Maryland, is that it's that you anything that you've earned prior. So basically, as long as you're not putting anything at risk, the game doesn't have to be as careful about disclosing what the optimal choice is. But if the player in any context has anything at risk, then the game basically has to be mathematically configured to provide an optimal, you know, disclose and have the math be basically in favor of
sort of game. Keep the pair, throw away the straight.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yes.
And I think also, you know, this speaks to, you know, being able to say, oh, I've got a good hand here, I'm going to up my wager.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, that just was the, it was the, so, yeah, I understand.
Right, and I think this is, you know, whether a state has its own slot lab or it uses an independent test laboratories, the purpose of that lab is really an extension of the regulator.
Yeah, of course.
And that's where you have, you know, your technical standards especially will be very fluid because as things come down the line, they will do the analysis of the games and they will alert you to provisions, features, and say, you know, what do you want to do about this? How should we treat this? Do we want to limit this? And, you know, it's one of the areas where there's a lot of consensus nationally. So,
okay. Well, thank you. I think this is very important. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for my own, I guess, I've been around a lot, and math doesn't seem to be the United States strong suit anymore. So I'm very interested in the rules of play, mathematically sufficient information for a player to use optimal skill. How many people actually have the ability to do that?
Well, that's the thing where basically it, and again, I mean, others are more technical people can speak better, and if I were had more time to prepare, I could speak better. But basically, the game, it has to enable you to apply optimal skill. So you don't have to.
You don't have to be a college graduate.
Right.
Right. Okay. So you know three of a kind is better than
that. Right. So if you don't, it'll make sure that you know.
And through the instruction of the game that's available to the public, it'll actually show you, you know, the different payouts. And so if you've never played, you know, a game of skill, specifically a poker game, you can actually learn how to play by reading those screens.
And those screens are done in a very attractive way and very open, you know, easy to understand. And they're a big part of the review that is done by the lab. Are they comprehensible? Are they something that the average person could understand?
And what we've seen, you know, if you go back, you know, again, 20 years ago, a lot of this was, you know, the players were relatively neophytes to a lot of these games. They've really kind of matured and grown with the product. And, you know, the perfect example is I watched my mother play on the slot machines, and she's just going, And I said, Mom, why can't you be like that with everything else?
I would agree. My mother, too, she can't get a mess. She can't turn the television on, but she can go into the bonus round.
Right.
Okay. Maybe we should have a vote on these, the insertion of these provisions, which clearly are significant and a step beyond what was in the original draft.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to accept these changes related to the slot machines. Comments? Discussion? All in favor? Opposed? All right. Yes, the next provision is a highlighted provision that's on page 29, which authorizes, directs the commission to adopt an annual fee schedule. Do you speak to that?
Basically, what agencies typically do is, rather than hardwire into statute or regulation the fee schedule for different categories of licensing, they publish on an annual basis the fee schedule. And I think this is especially important under our context because we have rulemaking for classifications of gaming vendors and employees, and there will be different pricing levels for that. So that's really just an administration of the agency provision.
Okay. And we've essentially talked about the highlighted item on the next page, I believe. It's just that the commission must have rules on these provisions.
Correct.
And carrying over to page 31, this also, the first one, 00, is requiring rules providing for the implementation of problem gambling. And that's with reference to the various provisions in this bill that relate to problem gambling. And the other provision is added to deal with the live entertainment provisions that have been added to this bill. Per our discussion last time, we brought forward the live entertainment provisions that are in the Massachusetts statute, and this closes the loop with respect to rulemaking on live entertainment. Right. I've got an insert at page 3124. Let's see what we have here. Oh, this is the delegation. I think the important thing here is that, well, two items. One is the unclaimed amounts, unclaimed expired tickets and so forth, the amounts that those are worth. This is W and double V.
We had gotten some. Originally, I had a different treatment of unclaimed tickets, of expired tickets and unclaimed prizes and winnings. And Director McIntyre had provided me with the language, which I assume mimics what you do in the lottery context.
So this is consistent with what the lottery does.
1 year after it's unclaimed, it reverts to the general to our revenues and then the Education Trust Fund. So. It's about 2% of our revenues a year revert.
So this is simply being consistent with
exactly right
the current approach. Then VV is delegation.
What's happening in that section is that we had certainly made a provision for a delegation of authority from the commission to perhaps its executive director or staff. And typically that would be in the context of maybe a bulk approval of non-gaming employee work permits, but there is a provision here which says that if that delegation of authority construed an action to be a final action of the commission, then this answers the question of what would happen in that context. And what's happening here is to clearly state that there's no attempt to go outside normal administrative practices here in New Hampshire. I kind of did this quickly, but we had included a description of the administrative procedures in Section 25 that Representative Weber had gone through and put together a section which really documented a normal administrative appeal process. And that this is really just designed to refer to that section to establish that we're not deviating from that in the context of a final agency decision in any context.
Mr. Chairman, those are significant. Again, I think TTE is changed. UU and BV are additions. I would move to accept those.
Right. Do we have a second on that?
Second.
Okay. And all those in favor? All right. Where are we? I think we keep turning the page. The insertion on page 32 says temporary operating regulations are not a prerequisite to a request for applications. That's making clear that you can start down the road of applications with licensing regulations, but not with you don't have to have operating regulations.
That would be fairly standard practice to run that concurrently.
That's how Massachusetts has done.
Yes. Pennsylvania, yes. And Maryland, all of them.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Can I back up 1 second?
Yes, certainly may.
I remember we had discussed this, but if you could refresh my memory, because I believe in prior legislation on that central computer system, it was a shell that developed this, and if I recall, there was discussion, and if Wade Sands could clarify that the May was inserted because we only are looking at one facility.
Exactly. This was just meant to be, discretionary in the sense that many states do not use a central system. New Jersey does not use a central system. Nevada does not use a central system. There are internal controls that can substitute for the controls provided by a central system. So because it's uncertain what the level of development would be, this is done in the case of may rather than shall. So central system is very expensive. It could be in the analysis that you determine that a central system is the way you want to go, and this provision, this enabling statute has everything you need as far as rulemaking for technical standards and a communication protocol for the central system. But I had used may rather than shall in case the scenario develops where you want to explore alternative internal controls to the expense of the system. Ohio, for example, I believe at least on the gaming side, not the BLT side, is not using, for example, a central system. So it's just discretionary.
Yes.
Not being real familiar, but after a facility is built, can it be retrofitted to a central system?
It could be, but certainly this would be something that the commission would want to address very early on.
It can be. It's more costly,
right.
And also could potentially disrupt operations to a small degree.
So you're saying a choice needs to be made at the beginning.
Yes. Exactly.
The wiring of a central system after the fact would be a factor over what it would be before the fact. Just because you would want to build out the planning of the, so that it would be Cat 5 cabling to the terminals to generate the data to the central system. You wouldn't want to do that after the fact. It would be very disruptive.
It's just and expensive. To make the cost decision when you have an idea of what you're going to build. If you were going to build one, if it's going to have 2,500 games, if you're going to build more than one, if you're going to build a bigger facility. So that was the thought process.
On its face, it would seem like a centralized system would allow you a stronger regulatory oversight. On space, but I'm not hearing you say that.
No, it doesn't realistically have to, because basically the central system is, it's more of a tax collection and certification process, but each slot machine, for example, is connected, if there is a central system, to the central system and to the operator's casino management system.
It's basically
system.
A mirror of the operator's slot accounting system.
Right. Under our regulations, under these regulations, or at least this statute, the commission, the state police, the attorney general have full access to the operator's system. The operator system has far more information on it than the central system. It's really just monitoring the operation of the system. So there's an alternative, there's a ready alternative means of access to the same information.
Just one another question. It seems like, though, the trend is that a lot of the older states are using the decentralized system. It seems like there's a trend toward centralization. Why is that?
Well, yes and no. Ohio's a newer jurisdiction, and they're not using it. We've seen it happen in some of the newer jurisdictions because it fell under the category of the VLTs. And VLTs require that because it was a central determinant system where the actual decision for the game was made at the computer here and sent to the actual slot machine. In this case, that's not what's happening. In this case, the actual decision of the outcome of the game happens at the machine location, and the central computer is merely just recording and displaying information. So that's kind of how that evolved. So in a true, what we call Class 3 commercial gaming, the central computer system is really redundant.
So, certainly, if I could, like our system, for example, is a central system that ties all the terminals together, and we have a redundant control system that is, it splits the transaction so that the transaction is housed not in two places, but it's housed in the central system, the backup data system, an ICS system, which is a mirror of the data center, and a backup to the ICS system. So literally the data is housed in four separate places in case there's ever a failure. And that's only because, as collective, the 40 states that run lotteries have all agreed to a minimum standard of control, that no wager will ever be lost, essentially. So for us, certainly, if I were building this, I would want this. I would want to have a central system. I would want to have that level of comfort knowing that I was not depending on somebody else's system. It would be that, and we would have the mirror of that system. And fundamentally, you would have the ability to check drop boxes, which is what some other states do. And I know it's a difficulty, but usually when you have a blind drop on the box from the terminal, the level of discrepancies, is, I would believe, is lower. Because you're going to have discrepancies, no question. Bill jams and the like, but...
County systems will have that same...
No, I understand, but it's like...
It's a decision.
Well, look, I think what we're hearing is there's an option here. There's a choice, and we can... and maybe we need to decide. We're either going to leave it to the commission. That's one choice. That's the drafting choice here as an option. Or we're going to make the decision here in the statute requiring that it be a central computer system. I don't think anybody's arguing for requiring that it be the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Those are the two choices. Do we want to discuss it anymore? I guess my bias is preserving the option. As technology rolls forward, I'd like to make sure that this commission has looked carefully at this and made the best possible choice. I don't feel comfortable making it myself. That's my bias. But shall we have a vote on this and a motion to approve it as written in the statute?
Question?
Yes.
Certainly my bias is toward whatever is going to end up with a successful product, and I guess guidance from House members, because I think that is where more difficulty will be than on the Senate side, is there guidance on what the House feels is going to lead toward the most successful product?
Not for me, if you're asking me. I wouldn't know. And I think one of the things we need to remember in the course of all of these discussions is that whatever we submit is going to be subject to hearings both on the House side and the Senate side if one or the other body passes something over. So all of these discussions are going to take place again, and the one thing I can tell you is that what will emerge won't look like what we submitted, but
I wouldn't.
But I think, well,
after all this work,
some changes will be made, is what I'm trying to say. And I guess my argument would be in favor of flexibility and somewhat in favor of kicking the can down the road, but I think that we have flagged the issue for people going forward. And this is just my personal thought, and I don't speak for the other 397 of us, however many we are at the moment. That's something that there's going to have to be another discussion on, just like the job classification issue.
Okay. So I need a motion.
I would move that we keep the language suggesting having it be a determination that may be made by the commission.
And I second that. Okay. Any more discussion?
Yeah, I just think the chair ought to put something in the report on it because I don't think I have the expertise to decide right. Which way it ought to go.
I think that makes
highlighted
sense.
Highlighted in the report as a decision to be made.
Good point.
I suspect if we have the experts come in who sell the centralized product, they tell us it's wonderful. And
yes.
Who get some other benefit by not, who tell us it isn't, and others will decide.
As in all things, it's just a matter of cost. Yeah. It's just a matter. So it's just a matter of cost and cost versus. Oh, what is he doing?
It's really cost versus job, because what the substitute controls are people driven, and that's a factor in a lot of states. And I just want to establish, have everyone feel very comfortable that there are accounting and internal controls that can effectively substitute. So it is a balancing of cost, depending, and all the cost is driven by the size of the facility that you're talking about.
The number.
Okay, are we all set? All those in favor, say aye, or raise your hands, either way. Against? All right. How are we doing? Okay, the next item is on page 33. And the concern here is the confidentiality of proprietary information. And I think it may be more specifically internal control protocols. I know that you've wrestled with this, Maureen, and
yes.
Maybe you could speak to it.
What's happening in Roman numeral 4 was just originally it was a little bit... commas in the wrong place that affected readability, but basically we're in the New Hampshire Open Records Act, and anything that's personal, financial, and proprietary that falls under those definitions for a gaming applicant or licensee would be protected in the normal course in the context of your Open Records Act. What's really happening in Roman numeral 5 is that while I'm sure the New Hampshire regulations have a definition of proprietary as far as an individual or an entity's financial records and things of that nature, they don't have the gaming specific proprietary. And so what's happening in Roman numeral 5 is just establishing what's proprietary for your operator, and that would be things like the marketing and player incentive and business intelligence and plans, your accounting and internal controls, your security and surveillance protocols, that those documents and any other documents that the commission would require as a prerequisite to operation would be considered confidential. So, for example, when you have a security plan and you have a floor plan and you have the security zones and surveillance zones designated on a floor plan and you have a minimum staffing analysis that shows how many officers are on for every shift and under what context, you certainly don't want to have that be a document that is open to open records disclosure. Mm.
Okay, that's the explanation. That's explaining your new language,
right.
Which is in the addendum. Can I move on?
Yep.
All right. I guess this next item is an addendum Oh, yeah. Down at the very bottom of the addendum page, 34-7, and going over to the top, there's a suggestion Director McIntyre made. It goes back to our earlier discussion, I guess.
Yeah, I think based on the earlier discussion, this is a moot point. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Withdrawn.
All right.
So we're deleting that.
No, we're leaving the language unchanged in the draft bill.
No, we're deleting what was on the addendum.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not acting on that. Then there's some highlighted language. There are several of these that reflect the votes, straw vote we took last time, single gaming license, and so forth. This is nice. I'm going flipping right through these. Page 39. This is the impacted live entertainment venue material that I mentioned before.
What about 37?
37.
A new number 8. Line 53.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
It's the child care services one.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah.
What is this all?
The proposed new language.
Oh, I get it. Yeah. Okay.
Allows,
I'm with you.
Commitment to child care services for employees, but does not provide for or facilitate services for the convenience of players.
Yes. This is new, and its companion is a deletion. Later on, of a provision that implicitly endorsed a provision by gaming licensees of child care for players. And that rubbed a number of people the wrong way, so much so that we ended up reversing course and putting this provision in, deleting that other provision. I think it's a good step forward. Yeah, I don't think we need to vote on pieces unless they're controversial, and they'll just be accepted. Okay, so now I'm back into turning the pages here. On page 39 is impacted live entertainment venue material. I'm just going to go right by that unless somebody wants to talk about it. Page 41 is a consistency piece of language that doesn't change anything. Yes, on page 41 is a standard provision that we're going to see several times, that these subordinate licenses, if you will, are 5 years in length and then subject to renewal. When I say subordinate licenses, I mean by that underneath the gaming license. I come to page 42, and this is another provision that also applies to other licenses. You'll see it elsewhere, and it says that for these subordinate licenses, the license continues in effect until the commission acts on it. Some of these licenses the commission may not get to when they expire and they need to stay in place.
Yeah, this is a normal provision that most every state uses, because a lot of times, you know, certainly the gaming license is always on cue, but there could be scenarios where there's a pile of permits or licenses or registrations that the agency has a little bit of a backlog. So that's just a stopgap to say that if you timely filed, that your license remains in effect unless you're notified otherwise.
Okay. Let's see. So I'm on page 43. A number of these provisions are the provisions that we voted on last time. But in the middle, this is page 43, starting with paragraph 3. One of the principles that we endorsed in that vote was was that although we are not going to be allocating funds generally that are received, seeing that is outside of our purview, the, whether or not funds go to the education fund or to transportation or whatever else, we are concerned that funds go to cover the regulatory costs of this new system, and that it also be committed to pay for any likely impacts of expanded gaming. So there are payout provisions on page 43 that relate to that principle of paying for consequences. And the first is that the commission itself will be that the state will be reimbursed for the startup funding. That's the first part of this. That's A, 1, and 2. Then in sub B, this 3B, we've got a provision that distributes to host or nearby municipalities. Is this where we've got a provision also for law enforcement?
That is in section 48.
Okay. All right. And then there's a provision that that applies some of the money to baseline research to try to establish a baseline with respect to particularly problem gambling in New Hampshire, so we know where we were when we started. That's what this is about. Yes?
You know, Commissioner Chairman, I believe B, subsection 3, would need to be amended under our new way of handling law enforcement to have a distribution
yes.
go to the local law enforcement.
And we've got that somewhere else, but we need it here too.
In 48, but we definitely need it there.
So
also.
We need an allocation to local law enforcement.
Right. So that would be a parallel treatment.
So that's the principle that lies behind those provisions. Okay. We're just continuing on here. All of these provisions relate to being very, very clear on what happens in an application process, what it means to have a complete application, what the grounds are for denial of a license, what a decision needs to be based on by the commission, what goes into that decision. It's all fleshed out here. And I don't have anything more until I get to page 51. This is impacted live entertainment venues. Again, it's the same material we talked about. But down in line 53, there's an addendum item. Yes. This was suggested by someone who, identity I've forgotten, it might have been Mr. Demers, that there be a time limit for a time by which the commission needs to issue its decision.
That's correct.
So we've got a 30-day time.
We incorporated that throughout the entire document. So for every level of license decision, it's a 30-day turnaround after hearing.
Seems consistent with general practice.
Right.
Okay, that on page 52, paragraph 19, is the same provision about the subordinate license. No, actually, this is the gaming license.
Yes, in that section, it is the gaming license.
All right. So we're into minimum capital investment on page 52. There are two things to discuss here. The first is subparagraph 4. And subparagraph 4 had within it two concepts. One was suspension of revocation of a gaming license for a gaming licensee who failed to obtain an operations certificate failing to do that within 1 year after the date specified in the timeline. And it also had a second piece that allowed a fine up to $50 million if there was bad faith. We split that paragraph into two parts so as to be able to make clear that a suspension of revocation would come after hearing and after a finding of good cause for that. Seemed good practice and appropriate that for such a big deal that there be a hearing and a decision that then could be dealt with. So that's what that's about.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I just want to make sure. So is this in the alternative, or can both penalties be assessed, both the revocation and then on top of that you can have the fine of up to $50 million?
You can do have both.
Okay, thank you.
Wasn't there a deposit that's made? Am I not remembering this right? $50 million.
There's a deposit of 10% of the minimum capital investment.
Which I guess is 45.
But that's in the very next section. As
and
a matter of fact.
Isn't that forfeited or something if there's a problem?
Yes. Yes.
So is this in addition to the forfeiture? There's another $50 million if it's bad faith?
Yes, that's following and that's actually following the Massachusetts model. There are a lot of consequences, but I think you have to keep in mind that you're going to have, when a gaming license is issued, a statement of conditions that goes with all of the conditions that go with development of the project. And that statement of conditions would be free to have provisions in it that would address delays that were unforeseen or that were reasonable. So when you would be looking at this type of provision, you would be looking at a situation where you really had substantial slippage. And so, it would mean that the project had not developed within 1 year after the date in the construction timeline submitted with its application.
I'd say they're really two different situations. One is the construction, and that's the second piece. And if there's completion of construction, the performance bond is gone, or the deposit is gone. But there may be a completion of construction and then delays in starting up for whatever reason. And now you're into a different ballpark entirely. So I see them as two.
So this deals more with operational issues rather than construction issues.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I guess I'm a little confused on the 10% capital escrow, because it seems counterintuitive to me is that an entity is going to borrow money from whatever source they are, and our goal is to get them to build the nicest, best facility they can, and yet you're basically saying to them, you're going to borrow money, and 10% of it you're going to escrow, and you're not going to be able to use. It seems to me we're taking 10% of capital for them to build the facility, and we're putting it in an account and letting it sit there and not utilizing it. I fully agree with the penalties, because you don't want somebody to bid on one of these and then play, possum and don't do anything. So I agree with all that, but I want this thing built, and a 10% capital expenditure to sit and do nothing doesn't make sense to me.
But it comes back to the final phase of construction.
It is released for the final phase. It's not just held aside. In other words, if you're on your construction timeline and you get to the fourth section, and you're right on time, that money is immediately released for your use.
It doesn't seem to spell that out. Is that spelled out?
Well, it's saying the licensee's says shall be returned to the applicant to be applied for the final stage of construction. So monies received from the gaming licensee shall be held in escrow until the final stage of construction, as detailed in the timeline.
Could you just tell us where you're reading?
It's a line.
I'm sorry.
It's
page and line.
Unfortunately, I'm on my document.
No, I can do it.
Well, if you gave us a section.
That is section 23.
Here it is. It's line 53-2. Line 2, page 53.
Okay. Is anybody familiar enough with large entities that loan money that would be considered a draw, that would be acceptable for them if they are loaning the money?
Attorney Sullivan.
Yes.
Okay.
It's really typical in construction projects, big or small, that the lender itself requires a 10% retainage to make sure that at the end of the project all the bills are paid. Now this is a little different because it's the state holding it. But that is so typical in a construction project. It's unusual in a construction project not to have, if you don't have a retainage.
Well, that would be taking your draw. They're not going to give you money for something that hasn't, you know. I understand that component, but that's the lending institution retains that money.
Well,
here, you're giving it to the state, so you borrow the money, but you're giving it to an entity other than the lender to hold it.
Yeah, you know, that's something you work out with your lender. I think maybe Attorney General Foster from his past life has also had experience with these things too, that especially with these entities, I mean, we're talking about very sophisticated, knowledgeable folks on the lending side as well as on the operational, the owner side, that they're going to be something that they've done before. This is not unusual, I think, in the gaming situation either. And so that they will... The bank's not going to say, okay, on top of that 10% the state's holding, I want to hold back another 10%. No, they'll work that out. You see it sometimes if you have situations with multiple financing institutions on a large project where they come through and bring on retainage and those types of things.
It'll cost you a fee or a point or whatever it is, 10%, you know, either.
Mr.
Chair.
But it won't delay their ability to borrow money and construct.
Okay. Certainly, to that point, I spoke to the CFO, Wynn, when he was interested in building up here as well. And he said, we can build a $1 billion facility in Boston, a $1 billion facility in New Hampshire, and not borrow a dollar. That in cash available. So to the extent that this is probably a non-starter for a lot of these companies, it's not an issue.
Okay.
This, by the way, is exactly the same language as Massachusetts has, and clearly they've had a lot of competition.
Okay.
So are we okay with the language as written?
And they can post a bond, too. Yes,
that's a good point.
About the fee, that's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Got a addendum item, I think. 53. Well, this is the transfer. Draft bill has a non-transferable rule. The gaming license is not transferable. The addendum language allows transfer with prior approval by the commission, essentially requiring that if there's going to be a transfer, that all of the suitability background stuff be complied with by the transferee.
I mean, it's a change, but in one sense, it's just a different way of handling the same transaction. At the end of the day, whoever the new players are, whoever the new persons are, would be qualified and licensed.
Yeah. So that seemed reasonable to me. Mm-hmm.
All right. This is to make it more marketable, right?
You know, it's...
somebody doesn't want to
has more value to somebody. They have the money in the ground, just merger and acquisition, maybe an asset transfer or something like that. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, it's really, you know, in part, it would be the transfer of the license would be invoked if there were 100% transfer, whereas the other provisions are the more likely provisions, which could also work for 100% transfer, but the more likely is that somebody's going to have a 5%, 10% share. And so what this is saying is that if the share in the licensee is substantial enough that the new acquiring person has to be qualified, then that transfer requires the prior authorization of the commission to do that. So it's really just a degree. At the end of the day, it's still pre-approval unless it's a transfer that is so de minimis that licensure isn't required.
All right. I think the one at page 55, line 14, which is an addendum, is common sense, isn't it? Just making clear what the background investigation applies to. I'm going to skip over that unless anybody disagrees. Go to. And the next one, the addendum item, is simply picking up that 30-day rule, as is the next, well, not right here. What we come to on page 55 in subparagraph 13 is a provision for the appeal of a decision by the commission that is not the major licensing decision. It's all other decisions. And thanks to Representative Weber, we have this language as your work, I think, is reflected here.
Well, it's not so much my work as it's just exactly the same process as required for an appeal to the Supreme Court, but it provides for the appeal to go to the Superior Court rather than the Supreme Court when it's a less important decision.
Yep.
So that for the commission, the procedure will be exactly the same in both cases so that there isn't confusion as to how things happen.
Well, so that seems makes sense. Okay. Oh, boy. We flip through this stuff, but this stuff is at the heart of this statute. It's the whole licensing certification process that's so core to having a good regulatory system. And I think the next big item that we do need to talk about is on page 69. Has to do with alcohol, which is always controversial. And we have a clear rule that complimentary alcoholic beverages are not provided or consumed on a gaming floor. The rule as written now on page 69 does allow complimentary alcohol beverages off the floor. That's a deviation from the state statute on complimentary beverages, and there's been some objection to that. I personally don't like it, I've been listening to those who say that this is a part of the gaming industry and it's what they do. We cut it off at the gaming floor, but if somebody comes, is brought in to stay at the hotel, why can't they be taken out to dinner with a free bottle of wine, that kind of thing. So I'm still listening, and we can talk about it. Do we want to simply invoke the state policy on free drinks, which is the statute? It's, I think, 179, section 44. Or do we want to have this allowance for complimentary service of alcoholic beverages off the gaming floor? That's basically the question for discussion. Do you want to chime in on practice, best practice, which is what we're trying to achieve?
Sure, sure, absolutely. You know, having been the president and general manager of a number of different gaming facilities, I can speak directly to my experience with that. Further to that, I've actually conducted analyses of gaming properties that do prohibit alcohol either on the gaming floor or throughout the entire facility. So, you know, I've had an opportunity to take a close look at their performance. You know, all personal, considerations aside, the raw facts are that the alcohol being served at certain gaming facilities perform better than the gaming facilities that do not provide alcohol. And it's right in relation right down to if it's on the gaming floor, those are the most profitable casinos. Now, a lot of steps can and should be taken to monitor and protect that. For example, not just bartenders and cocktail servers are trained in recognizing, you know, someone who's had, you know, too much to drink, but even the dealers and the floor people and the entire casino gaming floor staff goes through that training to identify potential abusers of the alcohol. Also, very, very strict checking of IDs to prevent underage drinking. It's just if you were going to be the only casino in, you know, a considerable distance, I think it would be much less of an issue. The biggest issue here is the competition. And unfortunately, people will make a decision to visit one casino over another if they have the ability to enjoy a cocktail while they're gaming.
While they're gaming.
Well, to be clear, we're only talking about a free cocktail as opposed to a cocktail they pay for.
Correct. Good point.
Right. They must be engaged in gaming.
Right.
So either at a slot machine.
No, I'm just saying we're not prohibiting alcohol entirely on the gaming floor. This is talking about complimentary beverages rather than
a complete
prohibition.
And, again, we even to that point, we've seen that where you must purchase the drinks versus not purchase the drinks. And again, the advantage always goes to, you know, complimentary and on the gaming floor.
Yes.
Oh, General Foster has seen it before.
So this that I'm reading suggests that they can track players as they're going, and as they're starting to lose, kind of walk up with a nice complimentary drink and maybe soften the pain a little bit. And that may be not true, but that's the suggestion as to what...
I can tell you, as the president and general manager of several different casinos, that is absolutely unequivocally not true. That is not how that works at all. It is, you know, you can be winning a ton of money. You can be eating.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I suppose if you're winning, they want you to stay, too, don't they?
Yeah. The key is, they
like to get to some of it back.
The key, just like anything else with the casino, is, to watch the abuse, to protect for underage both gambling and drinking. This isn't an entertainment facility for adults, just if you were going to a bar or a nightclub or a restaurant. And the same considerations have to be given for that.
Okay. Representative Weber?
I defer to Mr. Cheatham.
Sorry.
The question I had is, for those jurisdictions that don't allow complimentary beverages on the gaming floor, or in your experience, what was their reasoning, if you know it?
Okay, so the place that did that, they were tribal gaming facilities. And the tribes had made a decision about alcohol because of issues that they've had in the past with alcohol abuse and things like that. And so they made the decision that in all their facilities,
there was no alcohol. So when they consequently then opened casinos, they also prohibited alcohol there. What we've seen, and it is quite interesting, is that when they opened the casino, and there was no other casino around for literally hundreds of miles, it wasn't much of an issue. But as soon as a competing tribe opened the casino and offered alcohol, everybody went to the other casino, and then they actually came back and start and allowed alcohol on the casino floor, just in order to capture back that revenue.
Okay. I wonder, Mr. Demers, if you would be interested in chiming in. You sent a note in on this issue, and you represent Millennium and maybe have a different perspective from a casino operator's point of view.
Yes. Well, my suggestion was to actually conform to what the current law is in New Hampshire, which prohibits any free drinks. And this is an issue that's been debated for many, many years as this bill has been brought up in the legislature. And the Liquor Commission in the last session actually expressed concern about free drinks. And there had been an argument that it then gives special privilege to one bar in one form of drinking in the state that others don't have. And so our sense was that New Hampshire's had a long-standing policy of no free drinks in any licensed drinking establishment. And we think that it would make sense that that be consistent with the casino as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Weber, you've been waiting patiently.
I was going to say, just as a method of proceeding, this is another one of those questions that is going to be debated very robustly in the context of hearings. I certainly would personally prohibit complimentary drinks on the floor, and my personal position is I would prefer to go no complimentary drinks at all, because I think that the discussions among all the various people who are going to come in and talk about it, I concur exactly with what Mr. Demers just said about what we've seen about the discussion in the past, but that discussion is going to happen again in a very robust manner, no matter what we decide here. So I think it's one of those things that we ought to flag very specifically in our report.
We can write about it in the report for sure.
And, whatever way we choose to go here, perhaps I'd lean more towards allowing complimentary beverages outside of the floor for purposes of the draft statute, but with the knowledge that that's going to be talked about some more as time goes on.
I think we're going to have a vote on this, but let's have some more. Attorney Sullivan.
Yeah, I also think there's a misconception here, as there often is with respect to gaming establishments, and what actually is happening. There are not barrels of beer floating through the casino floor with people, drinking. And that's not the reality of, if you go to one of these facilities, as I'm sure some of you have, as I have, that's not what is actually happening. That is an occasional somebody walking by with some drinks.
Sometimes it's very hard to get to.
I was about to say, more frequently, if someone comes by and says, would you like a beverage, a beer, or whatever, fine. And you never see the person again. So it's not... it's a psychological fact that, if I go to the casino, I'm going to get a beer. But it's not a case of being at, like, you're sitting at a bar with drinks continuously being placed in front of you. That is not at all the reality of the casino experience that I have seen throughout various places around the country. So I actually like the idea of allowing this to be done.
Allowing this. What do you mean by this?
Allowing which?
Allowing what to be done?
Allowing complimentary beverages on the gambling floor as well as off.
Okay. All right. Commissioner?
This is a complex issue. As Mr. Demers said, there's a lot of history here. There are a lot of different interest groups. I don't think we have time to hear all that history and the complexities. I would recommend that we do not deviate from current law and let the debate be as this legislation moves forward.
Thank you. I feel the same way. Go ahead, Senator Rapp.
Well, thank you. I guess I'm not sure how I'm interpreting everybody's comments, but the addendum that we have, that page 69.5, 3A and B, as I interpret this, we would not allow complimentary beverages on the gaming floor, but we would not preclude an individual purchasing a drink while they're on the gaming floor. I would have no problem with that. Section B would give the potential for complimentary beverages as determined by the commission. And again, I would support this addendum item because, once again, we would be giving some flexibility to the commission to make that determination should competitive environments or other situations evolve that it would be beneficial for us to be in a competitive environment. We're not saying yes or no, but we are giving flexibility as how I interpret this addendum. And I would support that myself.
General Foster?
I actually think this is sort of in the realm of the stuff that I chose not to vote on last time. I think we're getting far afield from a regulatory environment. We're getting into, do we maximize the revenue or not of a casino? And that's not really where I want to be. So I think I'm going to defer on it and let others decide.
Okay. Well,
may I add one more comment?
Yes.
I would concur with Senator Walsh in that providing most flexibility in order to be competitive. If based on the demographic analysis that we've conducted, and we see that a lot of the customers will be in an area that can be targeted by both a New Hampshire casino and a Massachusetts casino. And if Massachusetts casinos do provide this, in the event that they are attracting more customers, having the flexibility to make a change later in the game would allow you to recapture some of that market.
Okay. Senator Roush, do you want to make a motion to endorse the proposal as written in the addendum?
I will make a motion that we accept the addendum item that is page 69, lines 25, section 3A, and new section B.
Okay, do we have a second on that?
I'll second it.
All right. All those in favor? What do we have? One, two, three. Six. And those opposed are 6-3. All right. So adopted 6-3. All right.
Chairman, am I understanding that that's going to be flagged in the report as to the concerns?
Yes, yes. Similar to that other item that we had where it was pointed out that it would be good to have the report address
the choices.
Yeah.
And to be considered again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm up to page 72 and down at the bottom. Self-exclusion, just pointing out that this unified system that we'd be moving into would enable provisions concerning self-exclusion to be generalized beyond the casino floor. Because that's what that's about. 47. Page 73, we've got an addendum item. But I think it's material we've talked about before, so that's taken care of. And 75 is more of this slot machine material. I think we've essentially covered that.
Yeah, it's in two different places. It's in this section, and then it's in rulemaking. So it's exactly the same language that we've discussed.
All right. So down at the bottom of page 75, there's a new posting requirement. This mirrors a posting requirement for table games. This provision was not in the previous draft, and it requires posting of such information regarding slot machine payout statistics and so forth to slot machine players as the commission shall require, but it does require posting.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Is that, how does that interact with the mathematical information that we added? Is this totally different, or is this also somewhat similar?
I'm not sure. I guess this is language that, I'm not sure what language we're talking about.
We're talking about, I think, two different things. I think the material we talked about before is on the slot machine, and this information that's available at the slot machine is also regulatory, is how the commission is going to approach the regulation of slot machines. This is posting for players who come in. There's prominent posting about, you know, you're going to lose all your money if you play for 10 hours or something
so
like that.
So this is very generic.
Yeah.
I guess, could I just have a site for it, because it's not in my draft, I'm not familiar with it.
It is. Page 76, line, 75.
Line 46.
Line 46.
It's 284B44.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't...
That's been in the draft, Maureen, for quite a while.
If I could just check, because that I want to make sure that we're talking about something that's feasible.
Yeah, I don't know. How do you disclose something like that? It's fairly complicated.
It's very complicated.
Going back to the sentence, could you use on math? I don't know how
Okay. Well, if it's not, if it's just the pay tables, if we're talking about the pay tables.
That's
yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Those are on the. They're on the
standard,
help screens.
Right.
Right.
If it's a video game, it's on the help screens. If it's a an actual real game, it's on, you know, the screen. It says if you get 3 bars, you win, you know, $20.
Right. That's what we're talking about. I just wanted to make sure.
You're talking about the odds too.
No, because it shouldn't say odds.
Right. I mean, I
it says the odds.
I'd like to look at that.
Payout statistics are common and traditional.
Right.
But odds are not.
Yeah. I'd like to. I mean, we'll certainly post what's traditionally posted. The odds of winning are more, the odds are disclosed on the help screens.
Mm-hmm.
They change.
And they change.
Yeah.
So I apologize. I'm not, I don't require, I don't know if the genesis of that was in 152 and it's something that just got passed me, but I think we take out the statistics. You know, and such other disclosures, and why don't we just leave it to the commission staff to do what's reasonable and normal.
What would the payout statistics say?
It should be pay tables, okay, which would give you a list that here's how much you will win based on the outcome of the game. So, you know, for example, Full House pays...
So what it doesn't tell you is if you played the game for 10 hours, what your likely statistical win is.
No, because it depends on so many factors, like how many lines you're playing.
Hate pay tables, should we not say pay tables rather than payout statistics?
Yes.
Because they really mean two different things to me.
Yes.
So the information, we post it on the back of our tickets as well as on our website.
Exactly.
All this, that exact information. Mm-hmm. We call it price structure, but pay table price structure are interchangeable in terms of terminology.
So we just read, a gaming licensee shall prominently post on its gaming floor such information regarding slot machine pay tables and such other disclosures to slot machine players as the commission shall require.
Okay. That sounds good to me. Are we all set on that? I think nodding heads are okay on that. I'm up to, maybe I'm moving too fast, but page 77.
This is gaming ticket expiration.
Actually, the first thing is, we went by that, but we...
It's just a mirror of the old language.
That mirrors the language, that's right. We're up to an addendum item, at least I am, which is 77, page 77. It's written as line 4, but it's really line 2. And this is where the local police, and that should be local law enforcement instead. All right. Then there was a request about changing the, this is line 17 of the same page, changing the $600 per year per slot machine fee, which is pretty much standard practice, as I understand it. Actually, the White Sand report says that. And what is it, is there anything special about the highlighted language just before that, Marine, paragraph 3?
No, I think the clarification was just that when the payment is made to the treasurer, it will be accompanied by a reconciliation document so that there's an audit trail.
Okay.
On the fact that the supporting documentation to the tax amount that's paid.
Okay, sounds good.
Nothing else.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask one question. I see that we have 1% of gross slot machine revenue. I know this has been in the news for a while for, I guess, for compulsive gambling.
Yeah.
And so are we talking about $900,000 a year or something? We think it's going to gross 900 to 90 million to 100 million, or what? What are we talking about in terms of gross revenue?
It's in the. Nobody really knows.
Yeah, I mean, certainly.
Right, I'm just going from their
numbers. Yeah, exactly right. You don't know in terms of total performance what the number would be.
We don't know, but the estimate is. Is that what you're estimating?
Yeah, it's in that ballpark. Your estimate was. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a matter of.
So it's about $1 million.
What the sizing would be to start.
$900,000 to $1 million.
Yeah.
I know there was some discussion among some whether that was a good recommendation or not.
The that's coupled with is also the $600 fee is tagged to problem gambling.
Of the same purpose?
Yeah. So it doubles. It basically doubles.
$1.5 million to $3 million additional.
Yeah, we'll come to that. So that's at the end. I've got it. We're not there yet. Just want to make sure we get everything else. There's a slight change in the prohibitions on certain political contributions section, page 79, to pick up, to have a broader definition, basically, of candidate to reflect current day political realities. I think Attorney Sullivan helped us with that. So that does bring us to I just note that this is consistent with our discussion before, but the structure, the organizational structure we're recommending includes a continuation of this body, but in a strictly advisory role, and that's on page 83. It would be strictly advisory. It would not do a charitable gaming study that in the previous version had been allocated to it. That concept, that undertaking is now in the separate expanded existing gaming bill and would be done by a special study commission. Unless anybody has anything before it, on page 86, we've got this, trick or sleight of hand.
The veterinarian may just will not refuse back to page 84 and recognize that thoroughbreds
Yes.
Should not be ignored.
We got them.
Wonderful animals.
We got it in an addendum.
Couldn't agree more.
We got it somewhere. Where do
it's
we have it?
It's at 444. On page.
On the addendum, maybe last page of the addendum.
Okay.
Yeah, we got it.
44, line 44.
We got it. Okay.
And that was confusing to me because it says restriction, and I wasn't exactly sure how to interpret that, which I got guidance from the chairman, and he assures me that the commission may authorize horse racing, harness, and with the addition of thoroughbred, if it so chooses.
Yep.
Is that the correct interpretation?
Yep. And the other side of it is that this kind of gaming that's provided for in this bill should be enacted, can occur co-located with horse racing.
Thank you.
So the last things are the last page, I guess, unless there's something before there. Senator Rausch, you're always paying attention, so maybe you've got something before that.
Nope.
All right, on page 87, I think there are two items. One is on this supplement to the addendums. This is what Maureen Williamson was flagging. There's an amendment to RSA 2014. It's really a housekeeping amendment to pick up the...
I think I had 24, and I think it's 27. So I'll double check that.
Okay, we're going to... That just needs to be corrected if the citation is wrong. And then the effective date language that's now in here would make the transfer of powers, rights, duties, and responsibilities to the Gaming Commission happen once the five commissioners were appointed, and put in a phrase that hopefully has meaning that the appointments shall be made at the earliest possible date after the passage. Yeah? Have we gotten through this? Yeah. Well,
it's 20:7.
What?
20:7.
Chairman, I was just thinking a little bit more about the alcoholic beverage issue, and I realize how sensitive it is. And as you go forward and debate that, something I would just like to offer up there for additional consideration is two things. One, you could always limit the complimentary drinks via the player card, so you could actually track that. And further, using the same type of technology, you could allow a customer to use their comp points to buy a drink, just like they use their comp points to buy a dinner or to buy an item in a gift shop. They could actually use the points that they've earned to buy. So just additional things to
keep
in mind as you move forward.
Got it. I guess we need to have a motion and a vote on this draft bill with the corrections, including those that are on the addendum, both all the additional items on the addendum, except as separately discussed and where variations from what was written here were adopted, something like that. So if I could have a motion along those lines, then we could see where we stand.
I will move to accept the draft as proposed. I'm not sure how you want the verbiage to that.
That's all right.
Because you're taking it to a potential bill format, so... I guess I will move to accept that as the document from this regulatory authority.
Okay. You have a second on that?
And to be included as part of our report as well as being taken to drafting.
Subject to editing, technical editing that may need to be done.
And the renumbering.
Acceptable. renumbering, things like that?
I'll be happy to provide the asterisk for you.
Maybe a little more than that.
Yeah, but not complimentary.
That's where the complimentary endeavors just come in.
That's where the Gruen importance as the work continues.
Okay, Senator Rush has made that motion, and it's been seconded, I assume.
Chairman Connors.
Chairman Connors. Any further discussion on this?
Yeah, let me just make a statement. I think the work this commission's done has been extraordinary, particularly the amount of work the chair has put in. So my upcoming no vote, I don't want to be viewed as any slight on the work that's been done. I think what ought to be obvious to anybody who's out there or sat through the work of this commission and those in the House who decided to defer on passing casino gambling made the right decision ultimately, because I think if we redlined this bill against what 152.0 was, it would be a rather lot of red and an awful lot of inserts. No matter how much work the chair has tried to do to try to make this appear as if we're not endorsing casino gambling, I can't vote yes and have my vote be interpreted any other way. I just don't. No matter what I say, I think it will be perceived that way. The department has opposed casino gambling for a long time. I think this regulatory scheme put in here probably is among the best that we could put together. I support that effort, but a one location with 5,000 machines with $450 million of capital investment strikes me as an endorsement, and so I'll be voting no.
Okay. Any other comments before we go to a vote? All right. We can do this by a show of hands. It's easier. All those in favor of the motion? Eight. And those opposed? One. All right. Set that aside. How are we doing on time? We're rolling right along. The expanded gaming, existing gaming bill. I don't know whether there's anything to discuss there. I do have a comment from Lucy Weber, and I'd like to pass it around. Is that all right, Lucy?
Sure.
Enough for to keep it down to the far end, that's right.
Mr. Chair, would you like some at the end of the table as well? Or?
Yeah, I think if there's leftovers, there should be extras. Okay, well, the introduction to this is simply that it's long, but that's mostly just reworking the statute. And so it's substantively, it makes few changes. The changes that it undertakes to make are designed to respond to specific recommendations for legislative action that were made in the White Sand Report and in the draft report of the authority that you also have before you. There's a detailing of the particular changes and a reference to the part of this bill that responds to particular White Sand recommendations. The White Sand recommendations included a recommendation for a study. It goes to sort of fundamental aspects of charitable gaming, and that is in the draft bill. And I guess the other feature that's in the draft bill has to do with gambling that crosses the border into illegal gambling, and a specific concern was raised in the White Sand Report with regard to slot redemption machines And that issue is addressed in this bill as well, giving racing and charitable gaming a role in the enforcement of that part of the law, bringing into the racing and charitable gaming jurisdiction some enforcement responsibilities, and also tightening up the definition of what a redemption slot machine really is, that relates to a definition of cash. And so all of that is in this bill as well. What we have here, I think, is essentially what we had 10 days ago. And when Representative Weber went through it carefully, she identified a concern.
There's only one change.
And I did send that to Director Kelly, and maybe we can short-circuit this and see how you respond to that.
Yeah, we're fine with change. We actually agreed that we thought we should hardwire the contract into the statute. We think that's great. We'd love to work with my staff and offer some language to do that. It's boilerplate. I think it'd be great. Other agencies do it. Crop insurance does, huh?
Does this language do it for you?
It does. However, I would say that language only concerns, I think it was Attorney Sullivan had some concerns. The last sentence says that the commission may void any agreement if it's not in the public interest, and I would defer to Representative Sullivan because she had some concerns with that language. I thought we agreed to take it out as a committee to switch it.
That's right.
So I think the boilerplate's great, but maybe we should take out that special concern.
No, I see what you're saying. That's a good point.
My concern, and you know, I have to say I seem to have recalled everything wrong from the last time, so my brain just reversed things or something. I liked the amended language that was put in. I was suggesting, my concern is that as I read the current language, it says that it requires that the agreement be in writing and approved by the commission. It doesn't require the use of standardized contracts at all. It says you're going to have them, but it doesn't require that they use them. And I wanted to make the commission have a little more strength in terms of its review. I'm now hearing for the second time the concerns about using the void as for public policy language, and so maybe that's not somewhere we need to go. I had a proposal that you've all been seeing where I sort of tried to incorporate the two. None of it's a deal breaker for me. My concern is really making sure that whatever the contract is developed does address the issues that were identified in the White Sands report. So that was the only thing I wanted to flag for people. I certainly think that what is here is an enormous improvement and starts travel in a direction that I think we ought to go in. So I'm not going to fuss about it one way or the other. I just wanted to flag it for people's consideration.
Was there anything in Representative Weber's proposal that should be added, putting aside this voiding of agreement? Yes.
Yeah, and I appreciate everything Representative Weber has said, and a concern about the ability to really monitor these things. But I like the language as currently proposed, the first language on this memo. One of the other things that the new language would do is say that the agreement's got to be submitted within 10 days of execution. I don't think it is a good idea to say the agreements have to be executed and then submitted. I think it's better if you submit the agreement, the written agreement, and the commission approves it. To say it's been executed, that actually now starts to create some obligations between the parties. Yet it can then be reversed. I think I'd rather not open the barn door until it's been reviewed, I guess is my point.
You could have the counterparty sign it, but the commission can't sign it without it, or the commission representative can't sign it without it.
All right. Do you want to withdraw your language?
And I've flagged, people have said what they want to say. I don't have any need to pursue it further.
Yeah. All right.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I see this, but the new language has already been incorporated in
That's
what
right.
I have.
That's
so
right.
Are we saying we leave this alone?
Yes.
Okay.
So now we need a motion to, unless we have something else, I'm not going to go through this bill page by page.
I would defer to
Oh, shucks.
I'm sure I would defer the racing folks to move. Defer the racing folks to move passage.
Yeah. Want to move passage of this? Move the. You want? Yeah. You move adoption of proposed existing gaming bill as part of the authority's report. All right. So moved. Second. All those in favor? Okay, we've got unanimity on that. Now, on the report itself, we haven't talked about that. I'm not going to go through that line by line either. You've had it. Is there? You've got problems with it? Speak up.
Just again, I guess I would like to reiterate what the Attorney General said. I would like to compliment you on the volume of work, the data you have gone through. Thank you immensely for chairing. And I just think that, I think I've said it in the past, I worked on 152 and found out I didn't know what I didn't know. And I do concur with the Attorney General that there's a volume of additional data, and I thank you for the wisdom you put behind this, and I certainly thank White Sands. I think they have been immensely beneficial to this process. So I thank you for your work.
I'll second that.
You're
not
great.
From all
of us. Premature on that.
Yeah.
Definitely not. But getting back to business, we do have this report, and I guess a motion I understand Attorney General Foster's dissenting position will be there, but what I want is endorsement for filing this report with adjustments. We identified a couple of items that I needed to speak to. I'll speak to those. So with some editing, I guess I need a motion to endorse the finalization of this report consistent with the conversations today. Is that all right?
So moved.
And second? Yeah. All right. All those in favor? All right. And I understand your reservation. Yeah. All right. Is that it?
I think so. That's the agenda. Sure, that's some stuff.
Can you believe it?
I'd like to echo the comments of the commission, but from a different perspective. We've worked with a lot of commissions and a lot of legislators throughout the country over many years. And by far, Jim and Maureen have attested that this has been one of the best working relationships we've ever had. All the members, and especially the chairman, have been dedicated to getting this done so quickly. And I think that in such a short time, to put out a really, really great product. And I'm just duly impressed and very, very happy with that.
Thank you. So where we're at is we don't need to meet next Thursday, right? We agree with that? I will file this report with a letter stating the support for it and the authority. Phoenix, being clear on that. And
sure.
And then, yes?
If you need sort of extra copies generated, certainly we should work together.
We should work together
on that.
Yes, I think. Don't know quite how to do that, but
I can certainly create sort of e-copies as well as paper copies if you want to have a certain number submitted in any office of the Senator or House.
Right.
As well.
Good.
For distribution.
Yeah.
I don't want to kill too many trees, but certainly.
Yeah.
I think it would be very helpful if we could submit both in a paper copy for the records, but
yeah.
also an e-transmission. So
yeah, I mean,
an e-transmission to everyone.
Oh. I can certainly, we can generate a one page.
To the same people who receive the report, so that, and it'll be on the website.
Yeah, so the website, sort of the front page of the website, as well as sort of just paper copies available both at our office as well as submitted various places in
yeah.
this building as well as yeah. across the street.
And most of you are aware of the legislative process. I will be taking this bill to the Office of Legislative Services across the street, and they have the jurisdiction, the sole jurisdiction, to develop bills for filing. They will take the electronic version of this and do it according to their format. We've tried as much as possible to do this in their format, but probably haven't, and but that's their business, and it will be double spaced. It will be a much longer bill when they're done with it than ours. A lot more paper, more like 200 pages, I guess.
Are you anticipating having people execute the report or not? In my case, or to reflect support or lack thereof?
You mean in terms of an actual signing of the report?
Yeah.
I could go either way. It's just physically, what do you think? I could sign it and say and describe the vote.
I suggest that you sign it on behalf of the commission and with the notation that General Foster
yes.
has the reservations that he has, which I gather are part of it.
Yeah, I will be clear on that. I think that's obviously that's easier logistically.
I think logistically
yeah.
that's
yeah. all right. Are we okay? Covered the universe? Yeah? All right. Good. Thank you.
Thank you. We may even save some money.
Okay.